in the most beautiful way that song, Hine Ehine, reminds me, and I hope reminds you also, that one of the central things that our souls are attempting to remind us of is the soul's own profound need for beauty, but also for discovering what beauty truly is, and of really finding the beauty in the everyday, in the magnificent world we live in, and in the beauty of one another. And of course, we inhibit ourselves in that discovery until the moment at which we accept our own beauty also. You know, beauty is perhaps almost more commodified than any other divine attribute. We're told that certain people have it and others do not, that we lose it as we age, and that we can destroy it without, or buy and sell it without some cost to ourselves. But of course, true beauty cannot be destroyed. It can only be claimed and appreciated. And in your growing into your own beauty, it is actually, I think, quite essential to allow yourselves moments of conscious appreciation of what brings your awareness of beauty to your conditioned mind, so that your conditioned mind is opening up more and more to the beauty of the spheres. This morning you will have heard the beauty of the bird song, which is not an interruption to your meditation, it's an integration with it. So think also about all the senses when it comes to beauty, how you're using all your senses, the sense of hearing, the sense of touch, the sense of smell, how you're creating beauty in the smallest gestures of kindness, for example. Whether your behavior reflects a respect for the beauty of the other person's life or does not. And beauty is not separate from what is not beautiful. It's on a continuum with. So we can destroy beauty and we can create it and we can participate in it. And again, those are choices of goodwill and of freedom. And in thinking about those very big moments of our lives, and the very big moment that will come in all of our lives when we leave the body, I think that we can soften ourselves and strengthen ourselves simultaneously through the practices of beauty. For example, I found in my room, I suppose it came from a pillow, although my pillows don't seem to be feathery. I just found it in my room. And then, of course, it reminded me of Hildegard of Bingen. And at our services at Pitt Street, where we've been having our services now for more than 10 years, we have the most astonishing music, because we have one of the world's great sacred musicians as our music minister, Kim Kunio, and he and I have made a number of CDs together, including In a Day of Silence, which I don't think we have any more of here, but also Peaceful Mind and Heavenly.
And Diva.
And we have Diva. where we have the diva singing, who is Kim's beautiful wife, Heather. And Kim and Heather sing a lot of Hildegard. And it was Hildegard who was one of the great Christian mystics and a scientist and an abbess and a woman of formidable intellectual scope who came with this phrase, feather on the breath of God. In other words, calling us to lightness of being, not to heaviness. One of you asks the question here, could you please elaborate on what it means to you that I am not alone? We discover this also through lightness of being. You know, there's so many words in the English language that teach us about the coexistence of the inwardness, the preciousness of darkness, and the inwardness and preciousness of light coexisting, one illuminating the other, coexisting. And this feather tells us something so profound about I am not alone. It tells me, first of all, that I am living in a universe full of and deserving of wonder. I am not alone in the physical universe. My metaphysical explanation also is that I am not alone in the presence of the mystery. I am not alone in the presence of my own soul and of the Supreme Soul, the Divine One, the Beloved, the Spirit, the very ground of our being. How can the ground of our being be both illuminator and ground? Because it's all one. Isn't that the most perfect example of the foolishness of the dualistic mind? All one. The feather on the breath of the ground of being, whom we discover through the passion, the fire, and the tears, the water of the search and of the finding. There is also a marvelous little story that the Buddha tells. The Buddha is also very obliging with the stories. And remember that these stories were held for a very long time in the oral tradition, which is also part of our tradition. We can also claim that. And that tradition exists, so therefore we need to think carefully about what stories we pay most attention to. It's very alive in our minds, the oral tradition, isn't it? So this is part of the oral tradition that held the stories until they were written down. That Ananda asked the Buddha. Now, Ananda is the Sanskrit word for bliss. And on my long journey to this moment, I once met an Ananda Marga brother who was called Krishna Sevananda, and I felt great envy because the name means the bliss of serving God, Krishna Sevananda. I said to him, I would like your name. He said, It's my name. Anyway, so there's this chap alongside the Buddha who's another chap. He didn't claim to be more than that. And Ananda said to the Buddha, is spiritual companionship half the path? What a good question. What a good question for us also today, isn't it? Is spiritual companionship half the path? Whoa. Because most of us get caught up with the rules, with the dogma, with the kind of theoretical construct, don't we? Surely that's more than half the path. Shouldn't we be thinking about the Ten Commandments or the Eightfold Path or the whatever it is, the Beatitudes? Shouldn't we be thinking about that? Shouldn't that be more than half the path? Spiritual companionship? And the Buddha said, no, Ananda. I bet he said, no, my darling Ananda. Because Thich Nhat Hanh always says, my darlings. Oh, so lovely. It is the whole path. Spiritual companionship is the whole path. How we're supporting one another. Everything else is just an illumination on the path. How are we supporting one another? That really comes down to not only conduct, but respect for what each person is giving as well as receiving. Yep. That's your tikkun olam. Your companionship with those that it is your destiny to be alongside in this physical existence. That's your destiny, that you'll be alongside some and not all others. But that you can also think about others as your companions. So when we pray for those who are near and those who are far, they're also our companions, but less seen, except through the mind's eye. Yeah? And so, Nancy, however we see them, however we conjure them up, is fine. However we see them. If we see them literally, if we see them metaphysically, it's all fine. We don't criticize the way in which our imagination brings them to us, or our imagination brings us a color or a flavor or a sense. We accept that's the gift of my imagination. Yeah? But what else does this ask of us? It asks that we honor. We honor what we have learned as well as what we are learning. Spiritual companionship asks us not to have to repeat the same thing over and over and over again. Honor our own experiences in order that we can bring them to our encounters, not talking about them, not referring to them necessarily at all, but just bringing them as part of the texture of who we are in this moment. We are increasingly textured, aren't we? Nothing is wasted. George's compost is with us always. Nothing is wasted, George. You've given us such a beautiful lesson, you spiritual companion, you. Yeah? And so often, we don't know the moments of our deepest and most meaningful companionship. It's sometimes in the moments of our idiocies. Yeah. Isn't that a relief to know that? It's very rarely in the moments of our perfection. But it's sometimes in the moments of honoring what we are growing towards in trust. It's sometimes in our honoring of our recognition that this also means a great deal to you, which is why it is spiritual companionship. Because in the outer world, this does not mean a great deal to many. So without in any way dividing one kind of person from another, nevertheless, honor in gratitude when someone else is encouraging you in something like the language of encouragement and familiarity that you need. It is not in any way to disdain all that you get and gain from others. But there is something so needed in explicit spiritual encouragement that wherever you find it and wherever you can give it explicitly is a place to be treasured. Isn't it? You know? And I so honor what you're doing, Michelle, at Stone Circle. Yeah? And I so honor, Hilary, what you're doing with the Auckland Spiritual Community. And I so honor each and every one of you for what I know and what I don't yet know of what you're doing in your places of being. Every single one of you, I honor that because I know you are bringing spirit to it. And in that, the person who asked this question, you are not alone. And that's the best answer I can possibly give you, because often what we're doing exceeds our capacities. Those of you who work in physical healing also know that some of your moments of supposed physical healing are moments of profound metaphysical healing of yourself as well as of the other. And in those moments, we exceed ourselves because we are not alone. And we're recognizing we're not alone. So the moment of recollection before in any encounter that would be difficult, the moment of recollection of who I am and that I am not alone, and that of who you are and that you are not alone, supports us in a very deep way that all the very best preparation of the cognitive mind, all that preparation is needed. All that hard work is needed. And an openness to spirit. I'm going to answer the other questions, but I think you have a question for us, Malaika. Is it all right with you if the question is recorded?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yesterday evening, before you shared the excerpt from the Gita where Krishna was speaking to
Arjuna,
you said something that resonated with me.
Can you all hear? Would you like to come forward and ask the question?
I think that's it, but I can reject a little more.
It's fine.
So you spoke about the importance of all lives, and it resonated with me, and I thought it would be interesting for you perhaps to reflect on what, how that relates to a little bit about what's happening within the U.S.
Sure.
And globally, but you're speaking of the phrase all lives matter.
Yeah.
To me, resonated more with the Black Lives Matter movement and phrase rather than the often antagonistic response of all lives mattering.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes this kind of space is an important one to talk about that, because from a superficial perspective, those of us in this kind of community that recognize all of us as one, it can be easy to want to resonate with the All Lives Matter phrase. However, Black Lives Matter obviously has a silent two at the end, Black Lives Matter two or as well. So, I just thought maybe it would be interesting to hear you speak on that, because I think these kinds of moments for me have created a space where it's important to talk about, and I think it's so amazing how you speak about social justice. So perhaps, I guess my question is, what are your thoughts on those two phrases and how they kind of work?
Yes, that is a completely wonderful question, actually. And it's a very timely question, because in Australia, but interestingly, it was taken up also by the New York Times, there's been a kind of argument against identity politics, which seems to me to be astonishingly naive. It seems to me to not just profoundly, but damagingly ignore the entitlement of identity politics coexisting, not just coexisting with, understood in the context of all lives matter. In other words, noticing that at the very same moment, and the human mind is perfectly capable of this, at the very same moment, holding the legitimacy, the unquestionable, and the should not be questioned legitimacy of identity politics with the context that if we began to understand all lives matter, we would be evolving at a far faster pace towards this ridiculous notion that somehow identity politics are no longer legitimate. I think that does a great wrong in understanding the actual causes and sources of disadvantage which have excessively, at a materialistic level, advantaged certain groups, while simultaneously it has often spiritually impoverished them. How interesting that that spiritual impoverishment often goes with the belief you have the right to conquer, whether it is through religion or culture or race or gender or sexuality. Inside all that of that right to conquer exists a notion of supremacy, And I think everyone in this room will understand it in one way or another, according to our particular journey, but I know that we can understand it because I think every one of us has either grown up in or come to a colonized country. We are very fortunate in this, in that we have an understanding of it. Now, the United States is also a colonized country, but they have acted as an imperialist country for so long, they have forgotten they were also colonizers. And this is a very, very dangerous situation to be in. So if I take it back to my own heart and spiritual practice, I realize that I'm very rehearsed, practiced in seeing injustice. And I'm so glad that I am. that is a gift to me from my mother and from my father. When I listened to Hine Ehine, I was feeling so much gratitude to my mother, who left the body when she was just turned 38. She was 38 and 1 month. When I was a little girl, my mother, who taught all the time of my childhood, when I was a little girl, my parents each had a one-teacher school near Gisborne, Te Araroa, and my sister and I were the only Pākehā children. And in my mother's little school, she had such a strong sense of what we would now call the legitimacy of identity politics. Of course, such a phrase was... So for her students, for her pupils, she not only wrote all the texts for them, so Hine could be present, and but also she illustrated them because she had both those gifts. In other words, she came to them as a student, not only as a teacher, which is how we need to come to all situations, in order that we are not also imperialists. Yeah. So I learnt that from my mother and from my father in a different way. They both had a big commitment to social justice. So I've grown up with a very strong antennae up for injustices. Where I struggle, and maybe this speaks to your question also, where I struggle is bringing compassion to those who are doing harm. You know, it is a very, very big struggle to bring skillful compassion. But I am so glad you asked this question, because our compassion is not one size fits all. So when I think of the damage done by the damagers, I have to think very hard about the conditioning of their minds that has allowed that has covered over their knowledge of their original beauty and their willingness and happiness to share that. And then, if I think of that, I could think, perhaps more accurately and truthfully, of the moments in which I also cover up my own. Maybe I don't have such a big cover-up because of the privileges of my spiritual experiences, but we all do something of that. But they are doing it on a macro scale. In other words, they are also offering us a profoundly unwelcome opportunity to see what the conditioned mind can do when we do not allow love to arise. When we ourselves are colonized by the forces of hatred, they are the colonized. Isn't that a terrible, terrible thought? They believe we are the colonized, that whether it's because we're women, or whether it's because we're not in the power group, or whether it's because we're in the wrong race or the wrong sexuality or whatever it is, those with this kind of power, including those people of goodwill who believe it is okay to go to war, who can make an enemy of the other so great they can send in drones to kill children without even a human being present to witness the destruction. Yeah? We can technologize our hatred, our otherness of the other, to such an extent that we no longer witness. At least in the olden wars, you had to get right up close. You had to get right up close. So, these macro examples are also examples to us. So how each of us responds to that kind of madness is part of our own journey. And it's certainly something to be shared and talked about with our spiritual companions. How do we meet that? Well, there are many phrases, both in the Christian scriptures, in the Psalms, it's really what I tried to write in Seeking the Sacred. It's really the breakthrough of seeing yourself in others and others in yourself, which would disallow that kind of conduct. So do we pray about it? Do we speak up about it? Do we write about it? Some of you, for example, and I know this is true of Paul and of many others, some of you are profound advocates for voices for the voiceless. And I believe that's you too. Voice for the voiceless. And we need to, because those who stand by silently may be complicit. But in our silence, we can also pray. We can pray not only for those who suffer the results of this ignorance, but also those who are the embodiments of such ignorance. We can pray that in good time, which is now, something will come into their hearts and minds so that they will actually look in the face of those whose suffering they cause and desist. And each of us needs to learn that too. Where we have caused suffering, or where we are tempted to cause suffering, look into the face of it and desist. I think it's one of the most challenging things. And for me, there were a number of years when I'd completely given up on Christianity, and I can understand why. You know, the institutional church offended me and still does. Well, it owes a vast apology, not least to people of every colour but white, but it owes the most profound, abject apology to every woman and to every person who was born with a sexuality different from whatever it was that was supposed to be the only one. Yeah, so that's quite a lot of apology. Mm-hmm. However, so during the period of not being a spiritual zealot and being only a political zealot, during that time it seemed simpler to me. I could just despise them. It's not so simple. And there is that great teaching in the Dhammapada: hate was never overcome by hate. Oh, I know exactly what I can read you from one of the most beautiful brothers of all. Oh, I marked it. I must have known this moment was coming. Oh, I'm so happy to have this to read to you. This comes from Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's book, Strength to Love. Such a brother. So this is a little bit of commentary from me first. The title of his book is already striking: Violence is Cheap. It cheapens life. It is also close to hand. It takes self-possession and strength of quite a different order to love and to heal. Hilary, could I ask you for a tissue? Thank you. To practice restraint rather than to dehumanize or resort to violence. Wow. It does. Thank you so much. In this personal recollection, Dr. King describes himself as being in a state of profound exhaustion, with his courage almost gone. This is also going to answer the question about alone. In that highly vulnerable frame of mind. Now, a highly vulnerable frame of mind is often when intuition comes in. I find that, don't you? A highly vulnerable, when everything's hunky-dory, not quite so much comes in. In that highly vulnerable frame of mind, with people still looking to him for leadership and example, he had nowhere to turn but inward. He takes up his own story. So now these are his words. I determined to take my problem to God. My head in my hands, I bowed over the kitchen table and prayed aloud. The words I spoke to God that midnight are still vivid in my memory. And these are the words he spoke to God. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right. I want you to remember that he was not only a peacemaker, he was a non-violent peacemaker. There's no peacemaking without non-violence. I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. He was emptied out. Do we not know this place? Mm-hmm. Oh, we do. At that moment, he said, I experienced the presence of the divine as I had never before experienced him. It seemed as though I could hear the quiet assurance of an inner voice saying, stand up for righteousness. Stand up for truth. God will be at your side forever. 3 nights later, our house was bombed. Strangely enough, I accepted the word of the bombing calmly. My experience with God had given me a new strength and trust. I knew now that God is able to give us the interior resources to face the storms and problems of life. Let this affirmation be our ringing cry. It will give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds and our nights become darker than 1,000 midnights, let us remember there is a great benign power in the universe whose name is God, and he is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. This is our hope for becoming better people. This is our mandate for seeking to make a better world. So I think we just take some silence to really let his words sit in our hearts. Yes, I will. It starts on page 271 in Seeking the Sacred.